Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 5 years ago, on the Oprah Winfrey Show, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg pledged a $100 million challenge grant to turn around the failing schools of Newark, New Jersey. Here is a clip from that announcement.
$100 million. And why Newark?
Why education? Because every child deserves a good education, and right now that's not happening. I've had a lot of opportunities in my life, and a lot of that comes from, you know, having gone to really good schools, and I just want to do what I can to make sure that everyone has those same opportunities.
And why Newark, though? Because, you know, what's your relationship with Newark?
Well, Newark is really just because I believe in these guys, right?
Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, on Oprah, pledging a $100 million challenge grant to turn around the failing school of Newark, New Jersey. And he's gesturing to these guys sitting by his side. It was then Mayor of Newark, Cory Booker, and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. They were all on stage together. Now, the plan was to not only repair Newark, New Jersey schools, but to create a national model of educational transformation. When Cory Booker became Newark's mayor, one of his goals was to turn the city into the charter school capital of the nation. But the effort, led by an education reform group of politicians, advocates, and outside philanthropists, neglected community input nearly every step of the way. They spent more than $20 million on high-priced outside consultants who charged $1,000 a day, which outraged members of the community. Also, teachers who were struggling to deal with or struggling to support children who were dealing with violence at home. So what about those children? Who's looking out for them, especially those living in dire poverty? In 2010, in 23 of Newark's 75 schools, fewer than 30% of children from the third through eighth grade were reading at grade level. The new book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools, provides a close-up look at the education reform movement and the challenges of changing public schools. Today's guest, Dale Russikoff, spent 28 years as a reporter for The Washington Post, covering education and social policy. The Prize, which was serialized in The New Yorker, is her first book. She's a longtime volunteer in Newark schools, and she lives in Montclair, New Jersey. Dale joins us from the studios of WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Hi, Dale. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And wow, what a great book. We've done so many shows on education and privatization and reformers. And I think you did such an amazing job of really just connecting the dots. So over 4.5 years, you chronicled the unfolding stories, and you got such amazing access to Cory Booker, to Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, to Chris Christie. You write that you were in dozens of classrooms, homes, neighborhoods. You spent time with families. How did you get such amazing access?
Well, I think it was partly that I was just determined to stay with the story for as long as it was unfolding. And I think it became clear to everybody involved that I was really interested in this for the long term, that I wanted to see it up close, not just from the perspective of those at the top, but also from the perspective of the families and the children who were supposed to be the beneficiaries of the effort. And this is something that, as a reporter for The Washington Post, I've always found the most interesting way to cover public policy is to try to sort of understand where the ideas come from, who came up with them, how, you know, what the vision is for implementing them, and then take it all the way down to the level of the people whose lives are supposed to change and ask, did it work? Why or why not? And so this was, you know, this was something I was really committed to doing. And as time went on, everyone did agree to talk to me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the district and what Newark, New Jersey schools are actually facing before we dive into the details. You report that 7,000 people are on the payroll. The school district was the biggest employer in a city of 270,000. In 2010, in 23 of its 75 schools, fewer than 30% of children from the third through eighth grade were reading at grade level. The high school graduation rate was 54%. But this is one of the stats that really got me. In astonishing astonishing 40% of newborns in Newark received inadequate prenatal care or none at all. And as you put it, they're disadvantaged before drawing their first breaths.
Yes, and that's really the context of Newark. It's a city that struggles with truly concentrated extreme poverty. Children witness violence on a stunningly regular basis. They have a lot of instability at home, and they bring all of this into the classroom. And that is such a big part of what's going on with the failure rates in school. I know that there's kind of a mantra of the education reform movement that poverty is an excuse for failure in urban schools. But that is true for some people in some schools. But it's also just a root cause of failure because the kids' lives are so difficult, and it makes it very hard to learn when you're living in those conditions.
You report that in a predominantly white state and one of the nation's wealthiest, 95% of Newark, New Jersey students are Black or Latino, 88% qualify for free or reduced price lunches, and 44% of children live below the poverty line. And this is twice the national average.
Yes, that's right. So that's what you're looking at. It's a very segregated city economically and racially, and it is really the kids and the families and the schools are struggling with the consequences of extreme poverty.
So let's talk a little bit about this relationship, interesting relationship, between then Newark Mayor Cory Booker and Governor Chris Christie. You also report that when Cory Booker became mayor of Newark, one of his goals was to make Newark the charter capital of the nation. Christie and Booker differ on a lot of issues, but on education, they're for the most part on the same page. How did they learn that about each other?
Well, I think that it just, you know, the two of them had known each other for quite a long time and had become friendly, going back to the days when Christie was the U.S. attorney, well before he was even talking about running for governor, and Cory Booker was still a city councilman running for mayor. And there were, you know, Cory Booker was running against a sort of legendary machine politician and was alleging that this politician and his organization were intimidating Booker's voters. And Christie actually investigated and deputized members of his staff to, you know, observe and patrol kind of the election day proceedings to make sure that there wasn't, you know, that there weren't civil rights violations. So their friendship went all the way back and they knew a lot about each other.
And so talk a little bit about how Cory Booker's vision of education and just his sort of star power, right? He had access to very wealthy people, and talk a little bit about why hedge fund managers especially were so drawn to Cory Booker's plans for Newark, New Jersey schools.
Well, Booker had become a hero of the education reform movement long before he was known in national circles, because he was a young African-American Democrat who was a very vocal champion of charter schools. So here was a Democrat in an inner city who was taking on the political bosses and the unions at a time when most Democrats were very loyal to teachers' unions, and that meant that they, you know, teachers' unions are very opposed to charter schools because charter schools end up, you know, taking children and money outside of the traditional public schools, and that means jobs, and teachers' unions are there to defend the teachers' jobs, of course. And so, yet Cory Booker saw the whole, he said that the whole existing system of public education was failing children, and he wanted to see charter schools replace district schools because he saw them as a better alternative. And when he started taking this position, he was, and this was when, you know, when he was still a city councilman running for mayor, a lot of these young hedge fund managers who had, you know, just out of business school working on Wall Street learned about him and told each other about him. And they got so excited about the idea of him as a possible change agent and candidates like him who might be Democrats who might be willing to take on the teachers union that they actually formed an organization of predominantly made up of hedge fund managers called Democrats for Education Reform. And they started supporting not only him, but candidates all over the country who had the same position on the teachers unions and on charter schools.
And so these are Democratic hedge fund managers.
Yes. Yes. They're liberal Democrats in every way, and they differ with the party and with the teachers' unions on education.
What did you learn about hedge fund managers? Because when we do shows about education, we throw around these names like the Broad Foundation, the Walton Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates. We talk about all of these wealthy people who are giving money to the education reformers. But what is it about these hedge fund managers? Why are they so drawn to this issue?
Well, I think that, you know, if you talk to them about it, they see this as they say that they deal in leverage all the time, like financial leverage. And they see charter schools as a way to put a lot of pressure on district schools and force changes in the way education is delivered. They see them as entrepreneurial, business-like organizations, and they think that they have the potential to deliver much better education to kids because they're not large government bureaucracies, they're not unionized, and so they just have a real interest. And many of them are actually supporters of, you know, they fund charter schools. They have charter schools of their own that they have funded and developed and expanded, and they see them as a way to, you know, like what they say is that the only returns that they want for the money they put into education is they want to see changes in the policy of education.
Now, I remember hearing about Mark Zuckerberg going on Oprah and pledging $100 million to Newark, New Jersey schools. And so many of us said he lives in Silicon Valley. Why is he doing this in Newark? So many schools here in California could really use that money. So talk a little bit about how Mark Zuckerberg connected with Cory Booker and Chris Christie.
Well, yes, Cory Booker and Chris Christie back in the in late 2009, right after Christie was elected, before he even took office, had come up with a plan that the two of them wanted to revolutionize education in Newark, because the state of New Jersey was in control of the Newark schools and had been since 1995, because the schools had been found to be, you know, shot, the organization, the administration of the schools had been shot through with corruption, and there was just a tremendous neglect of children and a high failure rate. So the state took over the schools, and Christie had complete political power over the schools. So they felt if they could find a philanthropist to support their efforts, they could dramatically expand charter schools, change the teachers' contract, change the way teachers were compensated, reward the best teachers, relieve the weak teachers of their jobs, all of this. And Cory Booker met Mark Zuckerberg at a conference of media executives and investors, where Cory Booker was a presenter, and Mark Zuckerberg at age 26 was attending this conference for the first time. And Booker and he went for a walk, and Booker started talking to him about what he wanted to do in education. And Zuckerberg, who was then 26 years old, was literally swept off his feet by what Cory Booker said about, he basically presented Newark almost like the public policy version of a tech startup. He said this is a school district and a community that's small enough that you could actually use it as a proof point for all the ideas of the education reform movement. We'll bring all these ideas to Newark. We'll have charter schools. We'll change the compensation of teachers. We'll have data-driven instruction. We'll have a whole new data system, a whole new evaluation system. And what he was saying was you'll come up with a model for how to turn around one of the most failing school districts in America, and then you can scale that up nationally and go to city after city with your philanthropy and solve the education crisis in urban America. And so he made it sound like, you know, this was like an early stage startup. And he talked to Zuckerberg about it in his terms.
And this is not surprising, because Zuckerberg at the time was only 26 years old. But you write that he was very open about how little he knew at the time about philanthropy. He recently had joined Bill Gates and Warren Buffett in pledging to give away half of his fortune in his lifetime. But unlike older billionaires, he had little time to devote to a foundation. He was heavily influenced, or is heavily influenced, by his wife, Priscilla Chan. And because Mark Zuckerberg is in our backyard, I want to spend a little time on this. I didn't really know much about Priscilla Chan before reading your book, and she has a lot of influence on Mark Zuckerberg, especially on focusing on disadvantaged children.
Yes, and in fact, when they were trying to decide, you know, how to start making an impact in philanthropy, it was her interest in education that got him interested in making a gift like this. And she grew up in a disadvantaged family. She grew up in the in Quincy, Massachusetts. Her parents were Chinese-Vietnamese refugees, and they worked 18 hours a day. her father in a Chinese restaurant, her mother working two different jobs. And she was raised by her grandmother, who didn't speak English. And she went to public school. And she credits a couple of her teachers in her public high school with putting her on a path that led to Harvard. And when she was at Harvard, she worked with she spent all of her free time volunteering in a social service program in two very low-income housing projects, where she worked after school with the children in the projects, not just on academic tutoring, but just on sort of social relations and how to navigate the day-to-day life of growing up in extreme poverty in Boston. And she became really, really just fixated and fascinated by the issues that these children face. And she said at one point that she thought, you know, these kids are me, but I had a couple of lucky breaks and my life turned out really well. And she just felt this is where she belonged. She wanted to work with kids like this. And as you probably know, she ended up going to medical school at UCSF, and she concentrated on underserved children. She did all of her internship and residency and her training in safety net hospitals in the Bay Area. And she worked with foster children. She worked with the children of families who couldn't, couldn't afford health insurance. And she really believes from her work and her studies that, children who grow up in extreme poverty and who witness violence regularly and have a lot of instability at home and in their families, that teachers alone cannot reach and do justice by these kids, that they need a lot more support. And so that's what she's interested in doing in education, is developing a school that would have all of the supports that children like this need.
I'm speaking today with Dale Resikoff. She's author of the new book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? And she writes about what happened in Newark, New Jersey. 5 years ago, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg went on Oprah to make a major announcement pledging $100 million to transform Newark, New Jersey's failing schools. So where did all that money go, and what has happened over the past 5 years? Dale Resikoff tells an incredible story about all the different players, the outside consultants who came in, who were paid $1,000 a day, while teachers were struggling to support children, in some cases whose fathers were killed in the middle of the school year. And so if you have a question for Dale, if you remember this announcement and you have a question about how this went down and how this connects to other efforts across the country to reform education. Again, at the time when Cory Booker became mayor of Newark, one of his goals was to make Newark the charter capital of the nation. So what questions do you have about these issues? We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. If you're a teacher, if you have a child in school, if you simply care about these issues, what do you see working in charter schools and what's not working? Same goes for public schools. And what are your thoughts about just this process, all of these millions of dollars being poured into reforming education? What are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Okay, Dale, so then Mark Zuckerberg makes this announcement on Oprah with Chris Christie and Cory Booker. They had huge smiles next to him. So then what happens in the meantime? I was surprised by how thin the proposal Cory Booker pitched to Zuckerberg. It was just a six-point proposal. But in the meantime, you have these amazing stories about how Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook are on the phone with Chris Christie and Cory Booker at all hours of the night, sometimes 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes. Well, in the months or the weeks before they announced this, Cory Booker and his staff were on the phone with Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, trying to figure out like what are the various points of what are the changes that we want to focus on. And they kind of came up with they wanted to completely change the teachers' contract in Newark so that Mark Zuckerberg's goal was to pay teachers a lot more if they were the best teachers, and to make it much easier to get rid of the teachers who were the weakest. And they also wanted to dramatically expand the charter schools, and they did that. There were they've doubled the number of children in Newark who are now enrolled in charter schools, and it comes to 40% of the children in the city. They also wanted to change the whole, all of the management systems in the school district. So they had a new teacher evaluation system, a new data system, a new enrollment system. A lot of these changes were, you know, seen as if you change the incentives and you change the management at the top, that you'll get, you know, that the you know, better education will trickle down and reach the children in the form of better instruction. So anyway, these were kind of the grand, this was the grand design, and they thought that they could come up with all of this in 5 years. They said they would emerge with a model for how to turn around urban education, not just in Newark, but everywhere.
It was just interesting to read your book and read about the conversations between Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, who's the COO of Facebook, and Cory Booker and Chris Christie. I mean, it's amazing that they had just instant access. Because they have tens of millions of dollars, they were able to call Cory Booker and Chris Christie at all hours of the night and talk about this new plan. I mean, did they know anything about Newark, New Jersey before talking about all the changes that they wanted to see in 5 years?
Well, no, but I think that they were looking to Cory Booker to tell them what kind of changes to make. I think that Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg saw Cory Booker as almost an urban Superman. They thought that he had turned back crime, an intractable problem in an extremely poor city. In fact, you know, there had been a period where crime had gone down dramatically in Newark, but by the time they were talking with him, it had gone back up, and I think they were not aware of that, and it remained a very, you know, heart-wrenching problem in Newark. But, you know, they were more aware of Booker's national reputation than what was happening on the ground in particular. And they were actually counting on him because they thought he also knew how to change education.
What did they say about poverty and the challenges that parents and teachers face in the classroom? Again, I'll ask you after the break to give us some examples, but you have really sad stories about students who, you know, just don't do well. How do you do well when your father was shot and killed? I mean, were they aware of all of those problems? And if so, what did they say about them?
Well, I don't know that they did talk about them in advance. I think that this was what they were doing was they were looking at this as a form of systems change, and they weren't looking at the classroom level and at the real issues that come up day to day between teachers and children. And that was one of the planning flaws with the whole effort, is that they focused properly on, you know, very dysfunctional management systems in the school district, but the issue of getting more resources to the classrooms and the schools so that principals could use them strategically to support children who are in these really, really challenging environments, that didn't happen, and that was probably, you know, a very important missing piece.
One of Mark Zuckerberg's top goals was to compensate teachers. He wanted them to make higher salaries as long as they delivered, for example, by bringing in higher test scores. And you write that, and this is so interesting, research has found no correlation between merit pay and student achievement, although reformers and venture capitalists were fighting hard to make it a staple. And teachers consistently tell researchers that given the choice, they would opt for a good principal and supportive working conditions over merit pay.
Yes, and that was true in Newark as well. I talked to they did get a modest amount of merit pay into the Newark contract that they negotiated. And I talked to quite a number of teachers who got the merit pay, and they said that they didn't do anything differently in their instruction of their students just because the merit pay was out there, that they were trying to get results for their students, and that was always the reward they looked for. They also felt that there was such a difference between working for a mediocre or a bad principal and a good principal, a principal who supported them, who observed their instruction and tried to help them get better and to reach their children more effectively. And they said that that was the kind of principal that would help them improve as teachers, and that's who they would prefer to work for. And the merit pay wouldn't have as much of an effect as a positive relationship with the principal would.
Today we're speaking with Dale Russikoff about her new book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. Stay with us here on KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with James Vanderbilt, director of Truth. It's a new film that examines the 2004 60-minute story that raised questions about George W. Bush's military service in the National Guard. You might remember this piece. It ran just a couple months before the presidential election, and immediately after Dan Rather and his producer Mary Mapes broke the story, it was heavily attacked. Most media outlets focused on the authenticity of the documents and the font on the documents rather than the allegations that George W. Bush went AWOL. So what caused this blowback and what does it mean for journalism? Mary Mapes was fired and Dan Rather stepped down. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today I am speaking with Dale Russikoff about her excellent new book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? And over the years in Newark, New Jersey, a number of politicians called the district budget the prize, and that's where the title comes from. And I'll ask Dale about this in a couple minutes. But she writes about the pledge, the $100 million pledge made by Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg 5 years ago to transform Newark, New Jersey's failing schools. When Cory Booker became mayor of Newark, one of his goals was to make Newark the charter capital of the nation. So where did all that money go? Well, Dale Russikoff reports that $21 million went to consultants, $1,000 a day, and $57 million went to expand and support Newark charter schools. If you have a question for Dale Russikoff or a comment about the massive issue of education, what are your thoughts about the hundreds of millions that are being poured into public schools, with the end game is to really turn them into charter schools. So what are your thoughts about that? If you have a child in a public school or a charter school, what are your thoughts about this education debate? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Dale Russikoff spent 28 years as a reporter with The Washington Post. Let's hear from OV in Oakland. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I wanted to make a comment on the term that you're using, reform. I think this term is a misnomer, and I would really wish that you would qualify that term by saying something like so-called reform, because I think it's misleading to use that term, because I think behind this are some motives around. One, the hedge fund people see the educational system as being a giant potential bonanza for them. It's hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that they are going to try to tap into. And so there's a profit motive. There's also a political motive of trying to weaken or destroy the teachers' unions, because these charter schools are not unionized, and that's been a long-term goal of the right wing, because the teachers' unions and the public service unions are really one of the few barriers to total corporate takeover. And it's just a general arrogance of having a few billionaires try to determine the educational policy for everything else. And behind this is also the whole neoliberal idea of privatization. So let's stop buying into the terms that are given to us and qualify it by saying so-called reform.
Yeah, thank you, Ove. I mean, I understand what you're saying. Sometimes I say so-called, sometimes I say quote-unquote corporate reform. What are your thoughts on that, Dale?
Well, I think that, you know, this is a movement that has named itself. They call themselves the education reform movement, and it's kind of become vernacular in the country. And it's used, but you're right. I mean, there are people who want to reform education who don't agree at all with this agenda. There are people in unions who want to reform education. There's people, you know, parents groups that have, don't have an affiliation with any side at all who want to reform education. So it's a, you know, it's a term that's used a lot, and often, you know, often in politics, reform, the word reform is used very loosely. I do want to say something, though. I didn't find any evidence that Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or any of the very, very wealthy billionaires who've gotten into education philanthropy are doing it out of self-interest in terms of trying to make money. I think they're making a lot of money in their own businesses, and this really is their philanthropy, and it's, you know, it's a very, I think their intentions are good, and they believe that the education system is on the wrong track, and they're trying to change it through philanthropy.
We did a show, you just reminded me, Anya Kamenetz has a book called The Test, and in her book, she reveals that while Bill Gates is a huge backer of testing, his children actually go to a school that doesn't test. I thought that was interesting. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, no, I think there's a lot of people in education reform who do something very different with their own children than they're advocating for the nation.
And also, Ove wanted to talk about money. We also have an email from Paul who says, thanks for this great show. Thank you for your reporting, Dale. I think you've done a great job exposing the pigs at the trough of public education funds. Can you speak to the distribution of public education funds? It seems that so many of these charter and reform solutions are creative ways of diverting funds away from the basics of public education. Paul goes on to say, I think that correcting our impoverished or our funding formulas to more evenly distribute funds to impoverished schools, irrespective of the tax base, would do so much more for impoverished students and schools than any amount of consultants or complex data metrics. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I actually ended up feeling that the most important thing to do in education in any city is to figure out how to get the maximum amount of money to the school and classroom level. Just as he said, the funding needs to be at that level because, and you know, to tell you the truth, I think that in Newark, the example of a school that I saw doing the best job of getting money to the classroom was a charter school. And what was evident was that this particular school they had more teachers in the classroom than the traditional public schools did. They had more social workers doing therapy with many more children every day, children who came into the classroom with severe emotional needs. And you could just see the effects of having those resources and spending them really effectively and strategically to support children. And that is the most important takeaway of all, is that we need a lot more resources at the classroom and the school level so that teachers, excellent teachers, can reach the children regardless of their needs.
And so many teachers told you that, basically repeated that same point in your book. How was that school able to have the resources that they need? Because in some classes, two teachers were needed to maybe deal, you know, work with the kids who are struggling and work with the kids who weren't, and then also give extra attention to the kids who maybe experienced violence in the home the night before. How are they able to get those resources?
Well, interestingly, the charters in Newark, and I think this is true in many states, it's true of all charters in New Jersey, they get less money than the school district per pupil. But because they don't have the same legacy costs and bureaucratic weight at the central office, they get a lot more of that money to the classroom. So they were actually, this particular charter school that I looked at was getting $12,000 per pupil to the classroom, and a traditional district school in the poorest catchment area in Newark was getting only $8,000. And that was really the difference, is that the district school had one teacher per classroom, the charter school had two in grades kindergarten through three. The charter school had tutors, one for every grade, who could push in when even two teachers wasn't enough. And the district school had like one tutor per for the entire school. And the charter school had three social workers. The district school had only one. So it was, you know, and the principal of the charter school said that her school, which dramatically outperformed the district school, she said they never would have had those results if they had had the same budget the district school had.
Hmm. Well, we have a caller on charter schools. Let's go to Amy in San Francisco. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm going to turn my speakerphone off. I'm a parent, and I've gone through public, private, and charter schools with my kids. I really agree with what the speaker just just put out there. And I just want to say two things. One is, I was really struck with, and I'd like you to comment on, these conversations that you were just talking about, between Booker, Christie, and Zuckerberg. It struck me that there were nobody from the education or the community
right.
were part of those initial conversations to set the priorities. So that's number one, and that really speaks to the possible failure.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I want to say is that I feel there's nothing endemically wrong with charter schools. Even the non-unionization, I think it really, really matters who the principal is and how the organization is run and what their values are. And what I experienced, for example, in the private school setting was that there was a huge value on art, on music, on theater, and that fed the academic success of the students and their hunger to learn. And I feel that one of the real failings of public school and to some degree the other schools is that they don't take, and many of those models are based on research about learning, whether you're living in dire poverty or you're living the good life, that these kinds of wide experiences for children help them learn.
Well, thank you, Amy. You brought up a number of points there. So, Dale, you talked about the success of this charter school. They had multiple people in the classroom. They got the support and the training that they needed. So how can that also apply to a public school? Why does it have to be the charter school does it right, but the public school doesn't, simply because they have one teacher and they don't have the support they need? I mean, we always hear don't throw money at the problem, but the fact is, to put more bodies in the classroom, you need money, right?
Exactly. And I think that part of the problem with the school district in Newark was that they were just spending so much in the central office. This is a school district that, you know, as you pointed out, it's the biggest public employer in Newark, and it's the biggest employer of all except for United Airlines, which is based at Newark Airport.
Wow.
And so for generations, it's been almost like an employment agency as well as an educational organization. And there are a lot of jobs at the central office that simply shouldn't be there. There are a lot of contracts that go to, you know, people who have friends in the right places that shouldn't be going to them. And if they could get a lot more of that money, they spend $20,000 per pupil in Newark. And as I said, that the one district school that I looked at was only getting $8,000 per pupil to the building and the classrooms. If they could get a lot more of that money to the classroom, they could have better results, and they could use the money strategically to support children who really need it.
Because there was such a microscope on Newark, New Jersey over the past 5 years, have you seen any changes along those lines?
Along the lines of getting more money to the schools.
Yes, and maybe cutting some of the money that's at the very top and the bureaucracy so it actually goes to the people in the classroom.
Well, unfortunately, there have been a lot of budget cuts at the central office because as the charter schools have grown, children and money have left the district and they've had to cut the budget to make ends meet. But they haven't gotten more money to the classroom. In fact, in the district schools, there have been budget cuts, not expansion of services.
Amy also wanted to talk about the lack of community input. And you write that for 4 years, the reformers never really tried to have a conversation with the people who actually live in Newark, New Jersey. Their target audience was always somewhere else. In fact, you write that in many cases, they went to Manhattan to have meetings with hedge fund managers about their progress.
Yes. Well, that was really one of the, you know, the very original, you know, original flaws or original sins or whatever of this effort was that there was, you know, as she pointed out, they were planning it on the phone with the mayor and, you know, an aide to the mayor and Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, but they were not talking to teachers and parents and community people, and many of whom had a real interest in seeing dramatic change in education. I mean, the interesting thing was that there was a real consensus in Newark well before this reform effort began that the schools were failing and needed to change. But none of those people were brought into the conversation. And had they talked to, you know, if they had just gone to, there are excellent teachers in every school, whether it's a failing school or a successful school, and had they gone to the excellent teachers in the most troubled schools and really made a brain trust out of them to figure out what's needed to make these schools better, they might have had a very different experience.
And this really did start a movement, because you write that at some meetings you'd have 20 parents show up, the next time it would be 100, the next time 200. I mean, people were really outraged about this, and they wanted it to change because they felt like their voices were not being heard.
Oh, yes. It became a true, I mean, it became a political movement in Newark, and was a big reason in the election of the mayor who succeeded Cory Booker. The person who won, Raz Baraka, who had been both a school principal and a city councilman, he was Booker's nemesis. You know, he was kind of the anti-Booker. And his mayoral campaign was almost totally focused on ending the reform effort as it had been practiced by Booker and Christie and Mark Zuckerberg. And the education reform movement and these hedge fund managers that you're talking about raised more than $5 million for his opponent to try to defeat him, and he still won decisively. So it really shows you that it was a very broad-based opposition.
Well, thank you for calling, Amy. Today I'm speaking with Dale Russikoff. She's a longtime reporter with The Washington Post. Her new book is The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? And she writes about what happened over the course of 5 years when Mark Zuckerberg pledged $100 million to transform Newark, New Jersey's failing schools. That $100 million had to be matched. So we're talking about $200 million. We're getting a few calls about how that money was spent. So you write that labor and contract costs were $89 million, charter schools $57 million, consultants $21 million. Again, they charged about $1,000 per day. Projects of local philanthropies, $12 million. Teach for America, $1 million. And the rest went to community grants. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Dale, just in terms of how that money was actually spent?
Well, I think that one thing that's really important is that, you know, the charter schools in Newark perform, and the students in them perform significantly better than the district schools do, as I was saying, you know, just in talking about that one particular charter school. And so the growth of enrollment in the charter schools is a significant improvement for the kids who are affected by that. But I think that, you know, the big picture was that they promised to raised the performance of every school. They said every school in Newark was going to be a high-performing school by the time this was over. You know, it was a five-year plan. And the district schools, where 60% of students still go, those are the traditional public schools, have not seen the gains that the charter schools have. In fact, the state test scores for kindergarten through eighth grade show that in every grade in both math and English, scores have gone down in this time period. And I don't think that that's necessarily because what they did was bad, you know, in terms of, you know, the managing of the district. I think the superintendent actually did a lot of good things. But the fact is that as the charter schools grew and money left the district schools had to close, consolidate. Thousands of children had to move around schools as their own schools were being phased out. There were layoffs of teachers, layoffs of staff, and the district schools are just in an upheaval that made it very, very, very hard to continue teaching kids in an effective way.
And the district schools were often where the students with the most need remained, right? Does that still apply today?
Well, that has been a problem all along because in the past, the charter schools had lottery admissions, so people actually had to apply through a lottery to get their children into the charter schools. One of the changes that came about as a result of this whole reform effort was that now there is something called universal enrollment, where parents select five schools. They could be charter or district schools, and 5 to 8 schools, and an algorithm sorts out who gets into which school, and it gives preference to the children who have the highest needs, either educational, you know, special needs, or children in the highest poverty. And so that should end up making a big difference, and probably no longer having the kind of selection bias that you used to see in the charter schools where the children of the more motivated parents tended to get in.
Well, we have a question on this issue of charter schools versus public schools. Let's go to Kathy in Oakland. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I'm a former educator, now retired, and a child development instructor was my career. And the way I see it, the reason that the money needs to go to the classrooms and the decisions need to be made by the teachers is that they see the needs of the children. I think we have well-meaning regulations and laws so that money won't be frittered away and misused. But there's too much distance between the lawmakers and the decision makers in the various cities and towns that is very disconnected from the individual schools. And I think that's the critical difference between the charter schools and the regional schools.
Well, right. And
that they are subject to law and regulation, whereas the charter schools have much more leeway in the allocation of, even if it's the same amount of funds, how they use them is significantly different.
And also, as Dale writes, again, you had hedge fund managers in New York, or Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO of Facebook in Silicon Valley, making decisions for the school in Newark, New Jersey. Dale, what are your thoughts on that? And have you heard from other people across the country about the lessons learned in Newark, New Jersey?
Well, I want to make clear that Sheryl Sandberg didn't make decisions about education. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg were basically leaving that to Cory Booker. But the problem was that Cory Booker wasn't talking to that many educators in making these decisions. The teachers of Newark, the principals, they didn't have input into the plans that came out of this. So that's one issue. But I think that, the amount of philanthropy that's going into education, that is, the money of very wealthy people, billionaire business executives, hedge fund managers, Wall Street investors, whatever sector they're coming from. They're very wealthy people who are using their philanthropy to try very, assertively to change the direction of education policy. And they want to see, in many cases, they want to see more charter schools. They want to see teachers held more strictly accountable for student performance. And they do have a very clear set of ideas that they're advancing. And they're able to do it because they do have a lot of money.
And what about just the disconnect between what they want by putting merit pay at the very top of their list, when you report that teachers tell researchers that they'd rather have good principals and supportive working conditions over merit pay? We briefly brought this up earlier, but are they listening to the teachers at this point after conducting this $100, $200 million experiment?
No, I think that they really believe, based on what they know from business, is that higher pay and pay for performance motivates people to perform better, and they believe that that's the way education should work, just the way business works that way.
Well, thank you for calling in, Kathy. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Mark in Oakland. Hi, Mark.
Hi, this is such a great show, and everybody's hitting such terrific points. The districts are top-heavy, and, I think that hurts the classrooms and the resources that are available. And the teachers need resources more than pay. I have two seventh graders in the Oakland School District, and, there's one social worker counselor for the whole school. Our nurse is shared by several campuses. She has to move around. So there's just not there much to support the teachers who are, have 30 or 40 kids, all with different socioeconomic and personal needs. Charter schools are a great solution to a problem that was created by the defunding of public education.
Right.
If we had proper public education funding, we wouldn't need charter schools, who then take the cream of the crop from the student base and leave the district to deal with the rest. But I really wanted to make a point about these tech giants who, putting their philanthropy money, to education, and it's a great thing. But as the last caller, made a terrific point that the approach is completely different in business. You reward people with money, and these people have been very successful in creating systems that work globally, a model that everybody can work on, and that's how they're approaching education. Whereas, you just can't get a one-size-fits-all silver bullet that's going to fix education throughout the country. It really is down to individual teachers and individual students in the classroom. And they need support more than they need money.
Well, thank you, Mark. And to add to that point, we got an email from Andy in San Francisco who says, while the intentions of these wealthy people may be good, I think that corporate capitalism leads us to depend far too much on the whims of the super rich to address our social ills when much of this money is rightly the property of all of us and we're the ones who should be able to decide where it is spent and who it benefits. Dale, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the... You know, the way we do philanthropy in this country is that we reward, we have tax breaks for wealthy people and for middle income and for anybody who gives, who makes donations to charitable causes. And, you know, that's the way our system motivates people to, you know, sort of, you know, help the government serve people is through private philanthropy. And not, you know, I think that I guess that was not a caller, but a writer.
Right.
You know, what he wants to see is a very different kind of system and much higher taxes than at this point people are willing to settle for.
So what were the lessons learned from all of this? I mean, you have a section about what Mark Zuckerberg learned, but how do you think this will affect the future of people who want to pour millions of dollars into education to completely transform the system?
Well, I'm not sure that people will have as grand or grandiose a vision of, you know, giving an amount of money and expecting it to transform education throughout an entire school district. I'm wondering if maybe what will happen is what, you know, was basically the lesson Mark Zuckerberg took, which was to sort of look school by school or community by community. I mean, what he's doing now is focusing on the Bay Area. He's not looking at a city far away like Newark that he's never visited but that has a dynamic mayor. He's looking at a community that his foundation staff can get to know intimately. He wants them to know the teachers and to know the principals, not just in district schools but in charter schools, to know the parents and to really be able to focus on the real needs of children. And I think that's, you know, that's where the focus needs to be.
He's also now talking about prison reform. He recently visited San Quentin and put a post on that on his Facebook page.
Yes, and those, I mean, I think that shows that he's really interested in, you know, solving or addressing addressing education for the neediest kids in the country. And that's where they are, that's for sure.
Dale Resikoff is author of the book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? And again, over the years in Newark, New Jersey, a number of politicians called the district budget the prize. And that is where the title of Dale's book comes from. Dale, thank you for joining us and thanks for your reporting.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll speak with James Vanderbilt, director of Truth, a new film that examines the 2004 60 Minutes story that raised questions about George W. Bush's military service. The piece ran just months before the presidential election. Immediately after Dan Rather and his producer Mary Mapes broke the story, it was heavily attacked. Most media coverage focused on the authenticity of documents rather than allegations that Bush went AWOL. What caused the blowback, and what does it mean for journalism? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.